There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full, so they're essentially...
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like. And so what we've seen are record numbers of baby boomers entering
rates
retirement.
Rates go up. If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio in any way, shape, or form, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon. Here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio, the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Steve Bertrand. Thanks very much for tuning in. Look at your cable bill, will you? We're going to talk a little bit later in the second half hour about hidden fees, not just on the cable bill, but the people at Consumer Reports have started sort of a new campaign. It's called What the Fee. I think their website is whatthefee.com, but they are trying to make us aware of all kinds of hidden fees that we are paying, and we'll talk about that. I think they're starting with the cable bill. That's why you should, too. On the phone line right now is Roger Chang from CNET, and we usually talk to Ian Schur on Thursdays from CNET, a senior editor. Roger today because Ian found better work, or at least he did yesterday. Welcome back,
well,
Roger. Yeah.
Thanks. I don't know if it's better work sitting in 6 hours of congressional hearings, but definitely a fruitful and active one.
Yeah, so Ian was in Washington to hear from Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey as they testify before first the Senate and House committees on them. Well, I mean, how would you characterize it? I think it was supposed to be mostly about Russian meddling, and it looks like it was for the most part.
Yeah, the Senate hearing was definitely about foreign influence. Russia obviously played a role in it. It was very different from just a few months ago when Mark Zuckerberg testified before Senate. These questions were a lot more informed. The Senate's senators' questions were a lot more informed. The atmosphere was a bit more collegial. It really wasn't until the second session, the House session, when it was Jack Dorsey, focused on Jack Dorsey and Twitter and censorship, that things got a little bit more heated, a little bit more tangled up, especially when the conversation drifted toward the issue of political bias.
I think it was a senator this morning saying that the Senate hearing, anyway, was the way government was supposed to work. It wasn't one party on one side, the other party on the other side. It seemed to be people who were genuinely interested in finding solutions. So good there. Sorry it devolved a little bit on the House side.
Yeah, exactly. It was the House is almost the diametric opposite of that. You had the Democrats that were, the Republicans mad at Twitter for showing more of a liberal-leaning bias. You had Democrats angry at the Republicans for even putting on this hearing and really, accusing them of political grandstanding. So it was definitely far less productive than the first session where, Sheryl Sandberg and Jack Dorsey, while they were contrite, did offer at least some constructive answers to some of these big questions, the big problems facing social media.
I know there was grumbling that Google wasn't there, and tell me the significance of that. I mean, would it have been a different outcome, a different day, had Google been there?
I think we would have gotten a few more answers. A lot of these questions were directed at social networks like Facebook and Twitter, but it's easy to forget that Google has a massive amount of influence between the 2 billion people who use Android devices, people who watch YouTube and comment on YouTube videos, the folks using Gmail. These are areas where foreign parties, hackers, bad actors can definitely exploit and really adjust the flow of the information that we get. So not having Google there was a pretty big deal, and yes, Google, I think, bore the brunt of a lot of the criticism and scorn from the senators. No, they were all very grateful and appreciative of Facebook and Twitter, and then they, I believe Senator Harris greeted our invisible guests today,
right?
In a little knock at on Google.
They were back in California celebrating the 10th birthday for Google Chrome. I would imagine that's what that was about, right? That was the absence.
It celebrated on Tuesday, it's a 10th anniversary.
Did I read Roger that Google Chrome has 60% of the traffic? And if that's the case, is there a worry that Google Chrome might eventually become too big or too popular?
I think that's a concern now at this point. But it's easy to forget that 10 years ago on Tuesday when it was introduced, it was sort of like a quirky experiment. People sort of saw it as potentially interesting browser, now it's completely dominant. As you said, 60% of browser usage goes to Chrome. And it's interesting because Chrome isn't preloaded on any other device. It's not like Internet Explorer. You actually have to actively go out and download it. And so, yeah, the fact that it has so much of the traffic flows through Chrome, it definitely raises the questions of just how neutral the Internet can actually be if Google really has a lock on how we see the Internet.
Roger Cheng is the executive editor for news at CNET. Roger, nice to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 1223. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, right here on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management, and he stops by most Thursdays. Bill, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
So I want to talk a little bit about pensions and where we are in pensions, but I haven't talked too much about how you found your way here or what got you into the whole business to start with.
Well, it's kind of tied into pensions, Steve. When my father worked for the same company for 30-some years, and he retired and he had a pension, and 2 years after he retired, the company that he worked for declared bankruptcy. The first thing that happened was the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation came in. The second thing that happened is they cut my father's pension in half. Now, the company's still around today, but for the rest of my father's life and for the rest of my mother's life, they lived on half a pension and sell the whole thing.
How does that work? So there's a federal guarantee, but then there's an agency that can review it.
The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
So
they'll step in if a company can't make their obligations, but they take over the funds and then they reduce the payments.
Right.
And Steve, this is what kind of drove me to get in the financial services industry. I thought it was horrible what happened to my father. We talk about this all the time. The thing that makes the world go round in retirement is income.
Right.
So we've dedicated our firm and our mission is to help people create their own pensions, if you will.
So that's an interesting point because back in the day, a worker was dependent on his place of employment for retirement.
That's correct.
Right? So by and large, you could count on a pension and getting one. Not
that's
always,
correct.
As your father's. And now we're at the case where we've got to sort of do it ourselves.
Right.
Which is harder, maybe, but gives us a little more control.
Well, there's a couple things. If you've got a 401k plan, you can roll that money into an IRA and create your own pension. If you do have a pension, and I have people all the time say to me, Bill, I have the option of taking my pension or taking a lump sum. What would you recommend? Immediately, I talk about using a lump sum. Because with a lump sum, you can create your own pension, if you will, and you don't have to depend upon your former employer for the next 20, 25, 30 years to make good financial decisions. That's tough.
You know any numbers? I mean, how many people out there still have a pension, active employees?
Here in Chicago, quite a few.
Yeah, government mostly?
Right. Government, but you also have some old line manufacturers and unions and stuff, and they have them. I sat down with a gentleman a couple days ago that had, I guess, like an $800,000 lump sum that he could take or the pension. And we're swooping that out of there, creating it, putting it into an IRA, and creating dependable, sustainable income for this person, which is a pension, right? But the difference is, with a regular pension, when you're gone, there's nothing left. With this, they're going to have something to leave to their family.
Right. So
a big deal.
If you don't take the lump sum and you're done, the benefit ends.
Yeah, the benefit. Maybe your wife gets it, but when you and your wife are gone,
then it's over.
It's over.
And with the
lump sum, you do it yourself, you can have an asset to leave on to your kids.
Let's talk, too, about 401ks, right? We talked about the fact that the president is considering requiring people to begin withdrawals. That currently is the case, right?
Well, everybody who has an IRA has to start taking money out of it when they're 70 and a half.
Okay.
It's called a required minimum distribution, whether you need the money or not. So you might not need to take money out, but you have to by law, and you pay tax on that. And if you don't take it out, there's a 50% penalty.
Okay.
If you're supposed to take $20,000 out and you don't, they're going to charge you $10,000 penalty.
And the government's requiring that you take it out because they're worried that you have food on the table, or they want the tax revenue?
They want their pound of flesh
right?
Eventually. Well, what President Trump is talking about doing is moving that age back from 70 and a half to somewhere in the future.
Okay.
And maybe reducing the amount that you have to pull out. That would be a great help to somebody who's retired. And it would help them lower their taxes.
I was going to say, in a way, it's sort of a tax cut for the elderly.
Yes, it is.
And is it going to happen? Can he do it on his own? Or what's the...
He put it through an executive order last week. The talk is that within 6 months, we should see something happening.
All right. So if someone wants to help get their help with retirement, develop a retirement plan,
right?
What is it that you do when they sit down with you?
Our big deal is we help people transition into retirement. You know, everybody's talking about how to grow your money. We help them transition to protect that money, and most importantly, to create dependable, sustainable income.
I like that because that's the part we don't think about. We think about the saving from it. We think about the spending of it when we're retired, but we don't think about taking that bridge into the income.
Steve, you don't know how many people I have come in, and they tell me, look, we built up this big pot, but we don't know what to do now.
Right, exactly.
What's next? And so we sit down and we put together a plan for them for how to do that. And that's a great lead-in for I know what you're going to talk about. For the next five couples who call in who have at least $500,000, we're going to create a complimentary, full-blown retirement plan for them and cover all these areas. We're going to do it on a complimentary basis for the first five callers. I know you're going to give the number in a moment.
All right, thanks, Bill. We'll see you. Talk again soon.
Pleasure being here.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. We talk about artificial intelligence quite a lot on this program, and I'm not sure it's something that I altogether understand. Steve Levine does. He writes about it in Axios recently. Steve's been on the program with us before. Steve, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks so much.
I'm interested in these studies you're looking at and the impact of artificial intelligence and how we're kind of in this stealth period now or quiet period. But before we get there, just talk to me in general about what it is we mean when we talk about artificial intelligence and its possibilities.
Well, that's a very good question. It seems to be fungible term. I think generally when we're talking about what we're heading toward is very capable computing power that can take over a lot of the business functions that are currently carried out by humans. So that would mean in the office, in the factory, doctor's offices, almost anywhere where we're doing routine work.
So is this, and you know, my questions are going to be a little awkward, but is this then a perfect sort of transition from the technology where we are, or is this a whole new generation, a whole new sort of technology? You know what I'm saying? Is this a natural progression, or are we like sort of quantum leaping here?
I think it's a quantum leap, but the people who are doing it, it's a quantum leap in capability, the impact on society, on jobs, politics, and so on. But the folks who are carrying it out have been talking about this really since the 50s, but in greater intensity since the 80s, and then it's really picked up over the last 2 years, let's say.
And even though then it's picked up and we're talking about it, you still write that it's sort of under the radar for a lot of people, and the people who are working on it relatively quietly are going to see great dividends where those who aren't are going to suffer in the future.
That's right. So we have in hand a new report from the McKinsey Global Institute. They're one of the key thinkers in this space. They've put a lot of resources into this. And what they're saying is that we hear and read a lot about artificial intelligence in our newspapers, on TV, and so on, including scare warnings right. about superhuman intelligence. But what we see actually happening is very little. So we could be lulled into a false sense of security that includes businesses, individuals, and countries that they don't really have to do anything. What McKinsey is saying, don't be fooled. there are certain companies and countries that are moving on this very aggressively, and in about 5 or 7 years, they're saying about 2025, that's when we're going to see a huge change. And if you wait by then to get into the game, it could be too late for you to compete. And that includes us as people learning the skills we're going to need to operate in that new world.
Is there a way I can learn those skills today? I mean, if I'm interested in that, what do I do?
Well, so it's the skills they're talking about are in two general areas. They talk about digital skills, and that simply means that you know how to operate in the space that a computer does. And so it can mean anything from coding to working in blockchain, in knowing how to operate alongside a machine learning algorithm.
That's discouraging. That means I've got some work to do there, Steve.
Yeah. So this is me too. This is a world we don't know a lot about yet. I mean, you could tell that what I hear, it is sketchy. They don't tell us everything. All we know is that we're going to have to be very familiar. All of us in all of our jobs are going to have to be familiar with how these computers operate. Almost no one is going to be immune from the new way of doing things.
And so it's interesting to me, we've got sort of three levels. We just spoke to the individual. There is the corporate or the business level of development, and then there's the government, the national, the country development. And according to this McKinsey study, the U.S. and China are leading the way and no one else is really close?
That's right. There's there are four levels that they've divided 41 countries into. The U.S. and China are all by themselves and really with no one close in that top level. In the second level, you've got countries, European countries plus Israel in there, and then it goes down. The list goes down from there, and it's but the good news for the countries and the companies too that aren't currently in that top space is that one level is developing AI, but the second level would be absorbing and enabling already developed AI. So if you're open to taking what someone else developed and making it work in your company, or if you're France, or if you're Russia, let's say, and you're open to applying AI developed by China or the U.S. In your economy, you could still be in the game.
And when it comes to the economy, this AI will have a real impact around the world.
Right, so they're talking, tens of trillions of dollars added to global GDP by 2030 from the addition of AI to companies, and an increase, a 1.2% uptick on average over the next 12, 13 years by AI, accelerating as we get close to 2030.
Right.
So yeah.
I was going to say, Steve Levine, I'm going to go work on my blockchain vocabulary.
Yeah, we all should be. This is something we all should pay attention to.
Read more of Steve's reporting at Axios.com. Great to talk to you. Can't wait for the next time.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. So you've heard me go on and on about how all of these suburban companies are moving their offices to the downtown area because this is where all the employees want to live. But SMS Assist, one of Chicago's startup poster children, is going against the grain. They announced that they're opening up a 400-person office in Naperville to, quote, diversify and reach into new talent pools, according to the CEO, Taylor Rhodes. One milestone after another for these guys. But their next goal, predictive analytics. It's something that companies will surely be flocking towards in the coming years. So it looks like SMS is ahead of the curve on a lot of fronts. But one thing people aren't flocking towards is Facebook.
pretty much the opposite, actually. A survey from the Pew Research Center detailed that 74% of U.S. adult Facebook users have either changed their privacy settings, taken a break from the site, or deleted it from their lives altogether. That's a lesson for you. No matter how big a company can get, there will always be uncertainty ahead. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Kim Gordon as well, and Violetta Padromedic. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WG, and it's 1252. Okay, so let's talk fees and hidden fees. Even sometimes they're not so hidden, but they just you don't pay a lot of attention to them, and they creep up on you. You end up paying a lot more than you need to. Tim Marvin is on the phone line. He's the campaign manager at Consumers Union, which is part of Consumer Reports, the nonprofit part of the Consumer Reports. Tim, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I do a little work in the travel industry, and sometimes, you know, I'll quote someone an airline quote, and then they'll go, you're already laughing, because they'll go somewhere else and say, well, I can get that ticket for $300 when I might have quoted them $500, and that's because of all the taxes and fees that airlines don't often publicize when they're quoting prices, right?
That's absolutely right, and so it makes it really hard for consumers to make an informed decision on everything from airline fees to cable packages to even buying a car.
And so what is it? I mean, I think a lot of us are just sort of resigned that there's not much we can do about this. Is there something we can do?
Yeah, well, people can go to whatthefee.com to learn more, but what we're doing right now is pressuring companies to be more honest about their pricing schemes. So we have a campaign targeting the major cable companies to be more upfront about how they advertise their prices. And then on airline fees, there's actually an FAA reauthorization bill up before Congress that would address some of these fee problems that folks are seeing. So we're encouraging people to write to their senator or their House of Representatives member and to pass a good FAA reauthorization bill.
I don't imagine there's, well, maybe you do have a statistic or a number. I mean, do you know how much we typically would pay in fees like this? I mean, that's got to be tough to come to because we all have individual lives, but I know a lot of us pay a lot more than we think.
That's absolutely right. Actually, we're working on that number right now. We've been looking for it too, and no, because fees are just so pervasive right, throughout everything that we buy, it's hard to put a number on that. But it's really become what we've been calling the fee economy, right? That the cost of everything is going up, but corporations don't want to be honest and upfront with that increased cost because, you know, people don't want to pay more. That's fair. But what we're seeing is that instead of just being honest about that increased price of consumer goods, they're hiding it in fees, and it's become this thing called the fee economy.
I can buy concert tickets and print them out in my house, meaning that the concert venue doesn't have to print the tickets, they don't have to mail the tickets, and yet they charge me a convenience fee for having to do that.
It's the worst. And, you know, just the other day I bought concert tickets and the advertised price was $20 and that's great. And by the time I was done, it was almost $60 right, for two tickets. That's a lot of fees and that's a big jump in percentage of cost. Even if it's only $10 per ticket, the overall percentage increase of that cost is astronomical. These fees are everywhere, and it's not just concert tickets. It's, you know, it's every your mortgage fees. It's, you know, car buying fees. And it's just becoming more and more widespread and more of a accepted practice. And consumers need to stand up and push back against
it. You're right. It is sort of the economy by fee because they are everywhere, and they are a little secretive. So if people want to join your fight, Consumer Reports fight, what do they do?
It's really easy. Just go to whatthefee.com. You'll see a petition that people can sign up to call on their cable companies to be more upfront about their pricing. But you'll also find some good Consumer Reports content at the bottom of the page and a space for people to tell us their story. We're learning about new fees all the time. Actually, we just got a good one in where with school starting, people are paying for their kids' lunch, and every time they upload more money to their kids' lunch account, they're paying $2.50 a fee. So if they're doing it by the week, it really adds up quick.
So if they're doing,
we'd really love to hear from people.
So the cost of a lunch is $5.50, but to load it for a week, it's going to cost an extra $2 a week. It's crazy.
Yep, it is.
All right. Well, I hope people sign up for this because I want you to bring my fees down, Tim.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Tim Marvin comes from, he's the campaign manager at Consumers Union, the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports.